Hi guys, it's Caroline Stephen, financial journalist. We have a talking trading classic today with charting legend Peter L. Brandt. We get a lot of requests from you guys to listen to and replay some of the very best talking trading interviews we've done over the years, and this is one of them. I have since interviewed Peter quite a few times, and we have a very good colleague relationship, and I'm very fond of him. But this was the interview that kick-started it all. Behind the scenes, Jack Schwager has told me that he wished he had have included Peter in his Market Wizard series because he thought Peter would have been perfect for it. But at the time, Jack didn't know about Peter's trading. Peter is articulate, he's inspiring, and he's willing to talk to other journeymen in the markets who are wanting to achieve excellence. But before we start with Peter, let's hear from Louise Bedford in Mind Power on how to find your own inner evil Knievel.
When I was a child, I used to love setting up ramps to be able to jump over them on my skateboard and bike. It was the era of Evel Knievel, or perhaps it was getting close to the end of that era. My friends and I would set increasingly difficult stunts for us to be able to do, and as a result, there was a variety of skinned knees and irritated little tendons of wrists and all sorts of difficulties and injuries, but we loved it. We loved the risk. We loved the thrill. And today, kids are growing up in cotton wool. It's very difficult for us as adults to see our little ones struggle, to see our little ones in pain after they've tried a stunt. But you know what's happening is our entire view towards risk has altered. If we don't change this view, it will make us timid and passive instead of bold and courageous. You see, sometimes the risks that you don't take are the ones that are going to cost you the most money. By taking risks such as improving your own education about the share market, by perhaps going out of your comfort zone or extending the boundary of your comfort zone, these are the type of risks that it takes to bring in the dollars. If you are that timid, passive, scared person, just know that you only have to see as far as that torch allows you to. Go to the edge of your light and then shine the torch again and you can go a little bit further. Develop a little bit of that Evel Knievel attitude. Remember when you were a kid and you thought that you were invincible? If you don't develop some risk-taking attitude, unfortunately, opportunities like learning how to trade might just pass you by. And that, my friend, is the biggest risk of all. Sick of wearing golden handcuffs? You know those, don't you? It's where you're in a role that pays well, but where you're trapped, unappreciated, unfulfilled, and bored out of your mind. It's time you learned how to trade full-time. Come to our one-day, 12 months of support seminar. I'm Louise Bedford. Go to tradinggame.com.au. Chris Tate and I are coming to Gold Coast, Melbourne, Sydney and Perth. Go to tradinggame.com.au for more details.
And the dates for Chris and Louise's one-day seminar are on the 10th of June, they'll be in the Gold Coast. On the 15th of July, they're in Perth. On the 22nd of July, they're in Melbourne. And on the 29th of July, they're in Sydney. To make sure you're in that room, go to tradinggame.com.au. Peter L. Brandt, hello and welcome to Talking Trading.
Well, thank you. It's my privilege to be on with you, Caroline.
Peter, in 2011, you were named one of the 30 most influential people in the world of finance. Your book, Diary of a Professional Commodities Trader, was Amazon's number one bestseller on trading for 27 weeks. You've been in the markets for over 40 years, and you're a classical charting legend.
Well, I don't know. I always think of legends as not breathing anymore. So I'm you know, I continue to hope that I'm not a legend yet.
How did you get your start in trading?
Well, I got my start at the Chicago Board of Trade, and at the time I had just graduated from college. We moved from Minnesota to Chicago. I was working in a different industry. But I had a friend who was a member of the Chicago Board of Trade. He was in the soybean pit, and I used to go down and have lunch with him.
The
and
soybean pit.
Yeah, we'd have lunch overlooking actually the wheat pit, but there was the members' dining room at the Chicago Board of Trade, and we would eat there, and I'd see these crazy guys jumping up and screaming and yelling and waving their arms. You know, at the time, it was the largest exchange in the world. And I was captivated by that. And the idea that you could find out at the end of the day how you did. You didn't have to go to meetings. You didn't have to write memos. You were your own person, so to speak. And generally, commodity traders did well. Of course, you knew about the ones that did well. You didn't always know about the ones that weren't doing so well, which you kind of find out after the fact. But so I was captivated by it, and I was young enough to make the decision that I could probably always land on my feet if it didn't work. So at 26 years old, I changed jobs and started working at the Chicago Board of Trade, at first for a grain exporting firm. And so you kind of learn your trade. There's no MBA fast track in the business of commodity trading. Everybody starts at the bottom. Everybody starts exactly at the same place. And that's where I started, and it took me about 4 or 5 years to really learn how to trade.
Now, you had a mentor, but you also went away and touched up the system yourself, didn't you?
Well, I had a mentor, but my mentor wasn't so much so valuable in terms of buy this, sell this, here's how you determine what to buy, what to sell. It wasn't technique, you know, it wasn't trade identification. It was a mentor more in terms of just guiding me along with risk management ideas, encouragement, the mental part of the game, which I think is frankly the most challenging. The mental part of the game and the money management part of the game, those are really much more important than trade identification. And I think 80% of novice traders today probably spend 80% of their time and money try to figure out trade identification, which is the least important of all the components to being a trader, which I find just ironic. But that's the way that is. But he was tremendously influential in terms of just kind of guiding me along. There were a lot of good, it was a funny kind of way of, it was a little bit like professional sports, you know. Yeah, professional sports, you can play a team where your best friend's on the other side of on the other team. After the game, you go out and drink beers, but during the game, it's war. And that's kind of the way the pits were, you know. During the day, it was war. But after the day, you know, you had a lot of people who were willing to befriend you, and that's what you needed when you were a young trader back then.
So your mentor gave you the psychology, and then you went away and finalized the systems, the entries, and the exit.
Yeah, well, that was a process. I mean, I didn't know how I was going to trade. When I entered the business, I just figured I could copy what somebody else was doing. I mean, there were plenty of smart people, and I could just find somebody and kind of coattail them. And kind of find out you can't really do that. I mean, you do learn that that doesn't work. And so, you know, I'd raise a little money, $4,000 or $5,000, and lose it, and try to raise a little grub stick again and lose it again. And I think I did that 3 or 4 times. But that's in the process of learning. I mean, the markets charge tuitions. You don't always get to determine what the tuition is. And so there was a point in 1979 when I stumbled on to what we define as classical charting principles, which go back to the 1920s, 1930s. And that made just a tremendous amount of sense to me. I delved into it, and it just resonated with me. And so I have been a classical chartist now for 34 years.
It has such a ring to it, a classical chartist.
Well, I don't know if it does. Maybe you think of a classical musician, right? a classically trained violinist or a classically trained singer. But I think charting is pretty much the same way. I mean, I periodically will go onto a number of different online websites, community sites during the course of the day, just to kind of get a feel for what sentiment is. I go to sites where people post charts, and I look at these charts, and I go, "Holy cow!" I mean, do these people make this stuff up or what? I mean, these charts look like maps of the stars. They just don't make sense to me. I'm kind of going, wait, where does this stuff come from? You know, I'm assuming that there was some crazy person that wrote a book 30, 40 years ago that taught, you know, these principles that these people are applying to their charts. But I look at most charts today and I go, my goodness sakes, I wouldn't know the first thing to do with all of these lines and circles. And they look crazy to me. They're not classical chartists. They're not classically trained. So I think there is something to be said about being classically trained in charting. A classical chartist looks at charts a certain way. What I find is 90% of people who claim to be chartists are not classical chartists. And I find that to be an interesting fact in the sense of trading.
Peter, what markets do you trade?
Well, I trade all the futures, and I trade futures globally. It doesn't matter where. I trade futures in Australia, trade a lot of futures in Singapore, we'll trade futures in Hong Kong, I'll trade futures in Europe, and of course the U.S. are most of the big futures markets. And I trade Forex. There's about 25 to 30 Forex pairs that I'll look at weekly.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I look at all the majors, and then there's a number of minors that I will look at, particularly depending on what I'm hearing from my global macro guys. You know, I'll take a peek at some of the minor stuff. But in general, I'll trade the majors. And I would say most of my trading is spot Forex. About 50% of my trading is spot Forex. And maybe 30% of it is futures, and the remaining 20% of it is probably equities, or as you say, over their shares.
Describe your approach to trading for us.
Well, I am a chartist in that I tend to look for geometry. I mean, classical charting is about geometry. It's about geometric patterns. And there are five major geometric patterns that a classical chartist will look at. Of course, the head and shoulders is probably the most famous. You know, double tops, double bottoms, rectangles, right angle triangles, symmetrical triangles. And there's a few other then more specialized ones. But I look for patterns on weekly charts. I have no idea how people make it as day traders. I would not even want to be a day trader. I think everything is stacked up against people who are day traders.
Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, it used to be when I went to the Chicago Board of Trade, is the general thinking back then, and it was not just true at the Chicago Board of Trade, it was true at Chicago Merck, at Comex, New York Merck. If you were a member and you were on the floor, it was okay to day trade because you had cheap rates. And more importantly than that, when you were on the floor, you bought at the bid, you sold at the offer, you were the bid offer spread as a floor member. And that was significant. And of course, you didn't pay commissions, and that added to the advantage you had. Well, if you're in the bid offer spread is owned by the high frequency traders. It's owned by the quants. An individual trader buys at the offer and he sells at the bid. And if you do that enough times, you're giving away your edge. And successful trading is about having an edge. You know, my edge is the fact that I'm willing to hold on to a position for 2-3 months. That gives me my edge. That's an edge that can't be taken away from me by high-frequency trading operations or quants because they're not holding positions. They don't hold positions overnight, much less over weekends, much less over months. And so I gain an edge by being willing to hold on positions for an extended period of time. Day traders lose all their edge. Their competition is the quants and the high-frequency trading operations. And I guarantee you that if I had to place a bet on a bunch of newbies who are day trading or the high-frequency trading operations, I'll place my money on high-frequency trading operations.
So you would recommend newbie traders do weekly trading?
Well, not necessarily weekly trading. I recommend they hold the positions. They hold they're position traders. I mean, everybody uses different terms for different time frames, and everybody has different meanings of what those words are. I think of scalpers. I think of swing traders. I think of position traders. Then I think of campaign trading. And, for me, even a scalper is probably someone who is in and out during the day, And so, I want to be a swing trader. As a swing trader, which is my shortest term trade, it might be a 2-3-4 day trade. But if I'm in a position trade, it could be 2 months, something like that. But I just think that the odds are stacked against day traders tremendously. And so I'd encourage a young trader to broaden their horizon and think actually about holding positions overnight, sometimes over many nights. And instead of looking for 1 or 2 pips or 5 pips in a Forex trade, think in terms of 500 pips.
Peter, describe your day trading for us. What does it look like?
Well, no, I'm not a day trader, so I'm interpreting you mean you're really asking me what's my day look like.
Yes. What does your week look like?
Yeah. Well, and that's a good question because I think in terms of weeks. My week starts Friday night, Saturday morning, and it starts when I look through a list of about 70. I scroll through 70 or 80 weekly charts. From 70 or 80 weekly charts, which cover really all of the futures markets, all the major Forex crosses, probably 10, 15 equities or shares, as you would put it. And I'll scroll through those on weekly charts. And from that, I will get a short list of 20, and they're charts where I think, and it could be ones where I have a position in, they automatically make the short list, or markets that I could conceivably think myself as being trading in that market in the following week. So I go to daily charts and I look at the daily charts of my short list. And from that, I really get my active list. And my active list is then probably down to 10 different names, markets. And that's what I monitor weekly, every day. Every day I'm looking at my active list. And so I determine then Sunday afternoon what my orders are going to be. I don't view myself as a trader. I really view myself as an order enterer. I make money by entering orders that make sense based on classical charting principles. And that's how I make my living. And, the idea of trading, I think, is over-glamorized. I'm just simply work at a desk and I enter orders. And so I will enter orders. They may be day orders. They may be good till canceled orders. But generally, I get in on stops and I get out on stops. I'm a momentum trader, although I do take profits with limit orders. I enter orders then on Sunday afternoon, and then I enter orders every day during the day in the afternoons. I do not enter orders during the day. I do not like watching markets during the day. I think I'm my own worst enemy in the markets. I think most traders are their own worst enemies. Their emotions are their own worst enemies. And so I don't view my competition as being the markets or other traders. I view my competition being my personality traits that attempt to sabotage me at every turn. And so what I need to do is be detached from the markets so that I can see the forest from the trees. Because if I sit down in front of a quote machine and start looking at prices during the day, I'll second guess the position I'm going to be in. I'll find a trade I shouldn't take. And so I want to do most of my heavy lifting on Saturday and starting Sunday when I enter orders. And then from there on, my heavy lifting is done at 4 o'clock mountain time in the U.S. each day when I take a look at where markets closed and what I want my orders to be the next day. And it's during that time from 4 to 4:30 that I determine what my order flow is going to be for the following day. And that's the extent of my day.
In your experience, does a position need to run straight away if it's going to be a winner?
There's two ways to answer that. I mean, the first answer is no. A position can take time to develop. It can horse around. It can test my patience before it goes. I don't want a position to close against me on a Friday or I'll get out. And I generally do not risk much in a trade. I risk, if it's a trade I really believe strongly in, I may risk 100 basis points or 1% of my capital. If it's a trade I don't have strong conviction on, it's a good trade. There's a pattern there, but it's just not a super pattern. I'll risk anywhere from 30, 40, maybe 50 basis points or a half of 1% of my capital. And as long as it doesn't stop me out, I'll try to give the market time to gather some steam and go my way. But the interesting thing is, if I look back at the trades that have been my best trades over this period of time since 1975, especially since 1981 when we founded the company, they were trades that went in the first minute and they went in the first hour. They're trades that went and never looked back. And we were in the money on the first day and we never were out of the money. There were trades that never put us at doubt. And I think that's been the true a characteristic of our good trades. And I always tell a young trader, if they want to know what works for them, they need to deconstruct the trades that worked for them. Find out what trades worked for them for you and then deconstruct them. What was it about those trades that made those trades unique? Because that's what then they need to look for. Is deconstruct your trades. I always just like to tell beginning traders that if everything's done by computer now, but we used to get a piece of paper, a statement on every trade we do, a P&L statement on every trade we close. That if I collected my P&L statements over the years since I started trading, I'd have a stack that's probably 10 feet tall. But now, if what I'd wanted to do is if I put those in the order, so it was the most profitable trades on the top of the pile down to the biggest loser at the bottom of the pile, and I started taking pieces of paper off one at a time with a goal of coming up with those pieces of paper which equal the net amount that we've taken out of the markets in the inception of our company, we would probably only take 10% of the paper off the pile. The other 90% were just there. They were there for us in the process of discovering prices. People say, "Why didn't you just trade those? Come on, guys, you're a bunch of idiots. Just pick the winners." Well, it doesn't work that way. Sometimes you have to discover. It's a whole process of discovery, and especially charts. People will say, "Well, charts don't work," and the reality is, for the most part, they're right. Charts don't work. I don't believe that charts predict prices, and
Really?
that's oh, absolutely not. I think all a chart does is it gives you an edge. It gives you a point to risk your trade if you're wrong. And but I'm not a believer in charting. If one wants to predict prices, I don't believe charts should be the place to start. I just think charts will give me some opportunity to say, I have an asymmetrical trade. I have the ability to make $10 and only lose $1 this particular situation, and therefore I'll just I'll play the odds on the trade. Because I think a lot of people that draw a lot of lines on charts and circles and so forth, what they're really doing is trying to say that if they study a chart hard enough, they will figure out where the market is going. Where I believe there's only one or two times a year in a given market where you act where a chart is actually worthwhile. All a chart does is show you where you've been and where you are now. And your markets tend to be momentum markets, trends tend to continue. And so if you know where a market has been and where it is now, you can at least find a chart that is trending and you can make certain assumptions that the chances are that it may continue to trend in the direction it had been trending. But I'm not a believer that if I can only study my chart hard enough, I can figure out where the Australian stock market's going to go. I happen to not believe that at all. I think that if I look through my 60, my 70 or 80 charts and scroll through them on a Saturday, I spend about 2 seconds per page. And if I don't see a trade in 2 seconds at looking at charts, there's not one for me. And so it's a pretty quick process. I don't have to sit and study a chart. Either there's a good chart pattern or there's nothing for me to really look at.
What other advice would you have for novice traders?
I think there'd be a couple of things, Caroline. I'd have to say, chances are, a novice trader, you're overtrading. You're trading too big. You're going to wipe yourself out. You're going to take yourself out of the ball game. It is going to take you 3 to 5 years to learn how to trade. And the question is, what's going to last longer? Is your money going to be gone before you've given yourself the opportunity to make enough mistakes to actually be a trader? Because that's how you learn, is by making mistakes. And when you make mistakes, it costs you money. And so if you're going to make mistakes, have them be cheap mistakes. Have them be mistakes where you're only risking a half of 1% of your capital. But be willing to take 3 to 5 years to learn the process, because that's really how long it's going to take to become a real proficient trader. I would also say that they need to probably paper trade for a year. They need to know what a trade is for them. You know, is this a trade or isn't it a trade? Because that's where the hard work starts. You know, when a trader comes to the point where they know exactly what a trade is going to be for them, and they're going to know how to manage that trade, and they're going to know how to size that trade, that's where the fun actually begins. That's where the work, hard work begins. And it takes some time to know for a person what that is. And you can't copy somebody else. It has to be something that's unique to you. It has to resonate with your personality. You know, I've seen it again and again, the idea of one trader trying to copy another trader's trading, because sooner or later, the one trader is going to go into a drawdown, and someone who's tried to copy them will give up the ship during the drawdown. He won't be able to go through the drawdown with the confidence in the trading approach that the person whose trading approach it belongs to. You know, I can go through a 20% drawdown. It doesn't faze me. It doesn't bug me. I know that statistically it's within one standard deviation of what I can expect. Beyond 20%, I move into the second standard deviation and, you know, run into some different set of money management rules, but generally actually it's an 18% is with one standard deviation of expectation for having a drawdown. And so, you know, it comes with the territory. I don't like drawdowns, but if someone's trying to copy my trading, and I even tell them every trade I'm going to do, if I were to pick up the phone and say, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm getting out here, I'm getting out there, I know that the chances are the person who I'm talking to on the phone will end up losing his money, because he won't be able to stay with me during my drawdown periods. He will give up at the low, and it's inevitable. And I've just seen it happen over and over and over again. I know my trading approach. I know the way I trade intimately. I know it better than I know my wife.
Don't let your wife hear that.
Well, no, she knows that. She'd be the first to admit it. I've been married 46 years, but I know my trading approach intimately. I know its heart rate. I know how it breathes. You know, I know its personality. And so, you know, a 15 to 20% drawdown, as long as I see that that's the standard, one standard deviation type stuff, you know, I know it. I know right now I'm going to go into a drawdown. I'm certain that I'm going to go into a drawdown in the next 2 months. I'm absolutely certain of it, because the markets are set up the way they're set up to do that. Well, someone might say, well, if you know you're going to be in a drawdown, why not just stop trading? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the point. I have to keep taking my signals, whether they're going to work or not. I'm not smart enough to be able to determine whether my signals are going to work or not. As a matter of fact, my win rate's only about a little over 40%. You know, I win 42% of my trades. That means my default expectation of the trade I put on is going to be a loser. Is I have to have that in my mind, is if I do a trade tomorrow, it's going to lose. Because the statistics are that that's the fact, that my default mental expectation of a trade is that I'm facing a loser with my next trade. And you have, a new trader has to go in with that expectation. 80% win rates are fallacies. I've never seen anybody have one. I'll take that back. Option sellers, short gamma traders can get an 80% win rate. You know, I've seen short gamma traders be right day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year until they go broke, because sooner or later they're out picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, and at some point in time, they're going to have to stop and tie their shoe, and that's when they're dead. And 80% win rate belongs to that type of trading approach, where a person's picking up pennies in front of the steamroller.
Peter, we're going to have to wrap it up. I'm so sorry, but very briefly, you live in the Rocky Mountains. Apart from classical charting, how do you spend your time?
Well, I try to travel. I've got grandkids 1,000 miles one way and 1,000 miles a different way. And so we go and visit grandkids. I play some racket sports. I like to read, although my eyesight, as I'm getting older, I'm finding I either have to go to large print or audiobooks. And audiobooks are actually pretty good because you can play them at 1.5 times their speed, and so you can get through them a little quick. So, but you know, I've spent my life waking up at Zurich time. I mean, you know, I go to bed at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and I'm up at 3 a.m. So, you know, that in itself kind of takes your ability to have a life away from you.
But you've achieved everything you wanted to achieve with your charting.
Yeah, you know, you start out thinking I want to do this because I want to make money. And every trader that I've met who I consider to be a peer trader, a journeyman in the true sense, every journeyman trader I've ever met has said, no, I'm in it. I might have come in it to be make money, but I'm here now to be excellent. I want to be excellent at what I do. I am seeking excellence, and profits will come after that. But if you seek excellence, you will find money at the end of the day.
Peter Elbrand, thank you so much for a wonderful interview. Where can people go to find out more about you?
I have a blog. It's www.peterelbrandt.com. How complicated is that? On Twitter or Stock Twits, I'm Peter Elbrandt. At Peter L. Brandt, and I don't know, I think I have 70 or 80,000 fools who are willing to follow me, and I happen to know that there are a lot of Australians in that group. So,
and your book is Diary of a Professional Commodities Trader. Thank you very much for your time today, Peter.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks a lot, Carolyn. Have a good one.
And stay tuned next week to hear an interview with top-level trader George Rolston. I'm Caroline Stephen. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to talkingtrading.com.au with Caroline Stephen. Make sure you are subscribed to this website to receive the very latest market views, commentary, and expert opinion. Tune in next week as we've got a bumper show planned. Bye for now.
The views represented on Talking Trading are general in nature and do not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Before acting on any of the information, consider its appropriateness in regard to your own situation.